Hey everyone, if you like this podcast, go behind the paywall to get privileged access to the smartest minds in finance. Visit realvision.com/RVpod and use the promo code podcast10, that's podcast10, to get 10% off our essential membership for the first year. Join the Real Vision community and learn how to become a better investor. And now to the top analysis of today's markets.
Is the Goldilocks camp getting too crowded? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Mike Alfred, Managing Partner at Alpine Fox. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Great, Maggie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Struggling with a little bit of the beginnings of a cold, but we're gonna power through. So this is the first time we've done a show together. I think it's your first time on the Daily Briefing, our end of day Daily Briefing. So why don't you give us a little overview of your approach at Alpine Fox?
Sure. And Alpine Fox just started trading literally 2 weeks ago.
Oh, so congrats.
It's a culmination of a 20-year process of learning and visioning, basically. But I'm finally operational. But I started trading stocks in my Stanford dorm room in the late 90s. So I was just trading penny stocks, tech stocks, basically anything that I could find that was moving. I was a history major, but I would wake up early and just trade. So I've been managing my own money for almost 25 years. Now, even though I'm a relatively young person still. But I didn't start a fund until now because I didn't see a great opportunity to do that. Because what I really want to do is long-term unconstrained value investing. And, you know, value investing has been deeply out of favor for more than a decade now. It turns out if you print a bunch of money and hold interest rates down near zero and basically allow index funds to proliferate widely, there's very few people left that are actually doing discerning valuation work on companies. And so that's what Alpine Fox is all about. It's a long-term value fund, take concentrated positions in equities, primarily in healthcare, energy, staples, and financials. But probably the kicker, though, is that I'm going to have a lot of Bitcoin in the fund. I view Bitcoin as a long-term value investment. It's not a popular view today, but I think it will be in 5 or 10 years from now.
And let the tweets begin. Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. And we're gonna talk a little bit about that. So it's interesting, your comment about the timing of the fund and how it was impossible. Do you see, obviously, because you've started the fund, you see an opportunity, but do you think an era of more active management is coming back?
100%. That was one of my kind of 5 bullet points in my memo when I raised the seed capital to start the fund. And I think, you know, it's, again, not a popular opinion because so many people want to go pure index. But it turns out, again, that if monetary conditions are harder and rates are higher, then you will see more dispersion in the returns of different assets across industries, across sizes, across geographies. And so I think there is a real opportunity for somebody who's thinking deeply about markets and has a longer term time horizon. I mean, everybody says they have a long term time horizon, but as you know, people tend to change their portfolios every single year and they turn over their entire portfolio often in the same year. And so when somebody like that tells me they have a long-term perspective, I sort of chuckle to myself. To me, long-term means don't put something in the portfolio you don't want to own for 5 or 10 years.
Right.
And that's kind of an old school view. It's more like a Buffett or an Icahn in terms of strategy. But I think that style will be coming back into favor because index funds are largely just making really naive allocation decisions that don't adjust for valuation at all.
That's so interesting. And I think particularly we've seen, just for people who are listeners every day, we know we've talked about this. Almost everyone that's come on has said, this is a tricky market now. This is one of the toughest mm-hmm. markets they've been in. There are a wide range of probabilities and they're having to be, we've heard, be tactical, be nimble. We don't have any major themes. We're going to really protect ourselves because things are so changeable. It's really hard to see into the future. And you're saying that, is that a benefit to active management?
It depends on what your time horizon is. Mm. I'm a point-to-point investor. So I'm really concerned with what will be the price of some of the assets I'm buying today in 3, 5, 7 years from now. And so I don't have to be so concerned about every short-term gyration, every little post-Fed volatility tantrum going on, because it doesn't really factor in to what I view as the fundamental value of some of the assets that I'm trying to acquire in 3, 5, or 7 years from now. And so, yes, I imagine if I had to worry about next month or next quarter, because my investors are going to get a statement and that statement's going to stay on down 5% or 7% because of I was flat-footed going to the Fed meeting or whatever. I assume that's how some people think about it. I really don't do that at all. And so I'm just looking at over 3, 5, 7 years, what can I own that I think will compound at an above, above mean type of return with lower than normal volatility over that period. And so I think there's a lot of things like that now. They're not necessarily things you can hold if you're worried about what your investor is going to think about your performance next month or next quarter, but over 3 to 5 years, I think it's a pretty safe way to invest.
We have a question right away from Colin related to strategy. So I think we should get right to it. And he's asking, do you have a low stock turnover or does it depend on the market you face month to month? Great question.
Yeah. So I'm planning to only hold somewhere between call it 7, 8 on the low end and maybe 15 positions on the high end. So it's highly concentrated. The ideas are mostly things that I've known about or followed for 5 or 10 years or longer. So I tend to stick to certain sectors, like in healthcare, for example. I'll follow some of the pharma companies or some of the medical device companies for 5 or 10 years before I buy some of them. And so in that case, no, I won't make a decision based on what's happened in the very short term, right? But what I am looking for is where can I buy really high quality companies at a reasonable price? And that's been the challenge, right? Like these tech companies are all wonderful businesses, but especially going into 2020, 2021, they were very, very expensive. It's very obvious to me that Netflix and Facebook and Shopify, and you know, if you listen to any of my podcasts from that time, I was telling people not to own those stocks. You know, they were just too expensive, right? And so even now, some of those businesses are too expensive. Whereas if you look in healthcare, for example, some of them are quite cheap, right? They're not bad businesses. They're just not trading at a high valuation. The market doesn't seem to like them very much at the moment.
Mm. So I imagine though that you have to have a macro framework that plugs in where the US economy is going. Are you in the soft landing camp? How are you viewing things right now?
I think it could go a number of different directions. And I've been thinking about it more in terms of like the level of the SPY, right? Because that's a really good proxy for kind of where the overall equity market is. And I feel like right around this level, like 410 to 420 is sort of a pivot point, right? If we go higher, then it's basically the market saying, hey, the Treasury General Account offset against the liquidity that the Fed is sort of pulling out of the system through higher rates and quantitative tightening is being fully offset and the market can essentially go higher. Remember, everybody's still employed. A lot of people still have a lot of liquidity from the pandemic era. Wealthy people, of course, are doing just fine, sort of as typical. And so I don't see a huge negative sort of downward impulse coming. But if we do see one, we'll probably see it over the next 3 to 6 months as the market fully prices in a recession. I think we may have already been in a recession. I think we're obviously in a recession in the technology space, right? Or in the crypto space. Like those areas got absolutely decimated last year. Many of those stocks and assets were down 40, 60, 80, 90 plus percent in the case of companies like Carvana, it was down like 97 or 98% at the lows. So in that case, you basically got a depression already. And so I think the question is not whether there's a soft landing, but what is the market already priced in? And I think the market's already sort of priced in a lot of negativity at these levels. And so I think it could go either way.
Yeah, that's a great point. And this is something that comes up again and again. My colleague, Andreas, just sat down with Bob Elliott for our new show, Buy Side Meets Sell Side. And he thinks a recession's coming. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Typically, if you'd see, 500 basis points of tightening out of a central bank over the course of a year, give or take, you would typically see that economy move into a recessionary state relatively quickly. And so the idea that, probabilistically, based upon how people have seen, markets and economies play out, the fact that we are probably moving into a recession, I think is a reasonable bet. It's a reasonable guess of what's likely to transpire.
And that full interview is available on the website. Just scan the QR code or hit the link in the chat if you're not already a member. And also put your questions in if you have any for Mike, and we'll get to as many as we can. You can do that in the live chat, or you can tweet us at Real Vision. It's funny, we're very observant viewers, Mike, and they love the fact that you have a full bar behind you. I feel like that was really needed last year, but people are certainly feeling a little bit better about the beginning of this year. What about you, though? I mean, if Bob is right and a recession is still coming, there's trouble still coming, you think stocks got a little ahead of themselves at the rally? I mean, we are down again today. We fell on Friday. Are we in for a consolidation or retracement here? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bob's right. I mean, this is the most obvious and most sort of telegraphed recession that I've ever seen. It's so obvious that it's coming that I wonder if it'll even matter to asset prices, or if the asset prices have sort of fully discounted all of it. And so that's, again, if I had to worry about what the market was going to do over the next 3 months, I'd be white knuckling right now, because there's so many cross currents in this economy that it's very, very difficult to tell what is going to be the winning factor. So will the S&P go up from here to 4,300, which is what all the Elliott Wave folks are saying, or will it come back down to 350, kind of where it was at the lows last year? Will it go lower? Will it go to 320 in a nasty recession? If you listen to somebody like Jeremy Grantham, he would just say on a pure kind of valuation basis with the number of headwinds that we have, that that's the level that we should go to. Again, I don't know, right? And so because I don't know, I try to just buy the highest quality businesses trading at a low multiple, because especially when you consider the cash flow component of that, like some of the stuff that I own right now is paying like a 7 to a 15% cash yield. And so really, I don't even really care if the security goes up a lot in price, as long as it doesn't go down a lot and I continue to cash that 7, 8, 10, 15% yield, because that's a good return in this environment. I think it's a great return, especially on a risk-adjusted basis. So if I can do that repeatedly, then I don't have to guess which direction the S&P goes next. I'll do that. Of course, if the market collapses 20 or 30%, I think right now I'm running at 70%, just under 70% cash, again, because it's a new fund and I haven't deployed all the capital. I wouldn't be opposed to that. But if it goes up, I'll also be averaging it. It's more going to be on a time basis than on a valuation basis.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
And that relates to a question from Oliver. When a stock goes down in your portfolio, do you buy more since it's a better value, or do you not average down?
Yeah. So look, I just finished reading Market Wizards, read the original version. I think it was 2 days ago. And then yesterday I read Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. And these are more like trading books, right? These are classic trading books, and it's all about cutting your losses early and letting your winners run, and basic kind of things that traders think about. But you kind of notice that Warren Buffett almost never does that, right? Like Warren Buffett buys stuff that the chart looks terrible, right? He buys it because he likes it for fundamental reasons. And then he tends to hold it, his holding period is sort of forever. And so I think there's a lot to be learned from those books. Like I generally don't want to average down heavy in something if there's bankruptcy risk. So if there's idiosyncratic risk in a company and I look at the balance sheet and I don't know because of the amount of leverage, whether I can go to zero, I'll probably be more careful about averaging down. Whereas with a company with a perfect, pristine balance sheet, where zero is not really like the left tail is basically cut off by the shape of the balance sheet, I think it's less risky to average down. Again, it comes down to holding period. If you're going to planning to hold that asset for 5 or 10 years, averaging down is probably a good way to bring down your average cost.
So you mentioned that you consider yourself a value investor. So what sectors, you mentioned healthcare. Is that still a top pick of yours? And what else do you like, or what do you feel that you know well enough to be able to make those judgment calls?
Yeah, I think healthcare is the best priced sector of the entire economy in the US right now. You've got really high quality companies. Like, I'm thinking of companies like Merck, right? Companies like Bristol-Myers Squibb, Medtronic. These are companies that are generally not that interesting to the average meme stock investor or retail investor, but they're trading at relatively low valuations. The businesses are doing fine, pretty high margins. Medtronic obviously got hit by the COVID period because people stopped doing as much sort of elective surgeries and other things like that. But I think when you look out 5 or 10 years from a demographic standpoint, healthcare is the one industry that you know there's always going to be demand. I put healthcare up there with sort of energy and sort of staples, right? Like food and beverages. And that's another sector. I love food and beverages, but like I loved Pepsi and Procter & Gamble in 2018. Those were my two big buys in 2018, May and June. I took new positions in both of them, but I would never put new money into them now because I'm not as interested in them at 25 or 26 times earnings. More interested in them at 15, 17, 18 times earnings. So I think it kind of comes down to what kind of business can you buy at what valuation? And so energy looks still kind of interesting. My problem with energy is it's kind of cyclical. And if we do see a nasty recession, especially the producers, they can sell off 30, 40% plus. Whereas if you look at like a midstream company, like I'm thinking of somebody like an Enterprise Product Partners, EPD is the ticker. It's a midstream business, like a toll booth business. And so it's really more about volumes and price. Something like that is trading at still a relatively low multiple of cash flow. And so I think you can put that in a portfolio right now with a lot less risk than say Chevron or ExxonMobil.
Mm. And you mentioned you loved Pepsi and some of the consumer products earlier. You're not loving them as much now. So you hang on to them because you get the yield. What's the thought process around that?
So the question is like, again, for personal reasons or professional reasons, like personal reasons, I generally don't like to generate taxable events, right? So I will hold a stock for a long period of time, as long as I still think it's a good business. Like I think Pepsi will probably compound at somewhere between 7 and 11% over the next, call it 5 or 10 years. When I bought it in 2018, it was more like a 13 or 15% CAGR type of opportunity because it was trading at a lower valuation. And so would I put it in a professionally run fund right now? No. Would I ever sell it? Probably not. Pepsi is one of the best run companies in the world. The products sets, even you think of brands like Gatorade, for example, right? Frito-Lay, right? They're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're growing. Diageo is another one that I love. It's a little too expensive right now, but if it were to drop from where it's like 174 right now, if it were to drop down into like the 150s, I'd probably add it in. I own Constellation Brands, which is the company in the US that sells Pacifico, Corona, Modelo. Turns out in the beer space, like beer's kind of been a crappy subsector of the alcohol industry. Spirits has been crushing beer for many, many years. But you look at a company like Diageo or Brown-Forman, when they get cheap enough, when I say cheap enough, for Diageo, it might be 20 times earnings. And for Brown-Forman, it might be 25 times earnings. They're actually great businesses to own. They're relatively sort of demand inelastic, sort of like tobacco, right? People just continue to consume them sort of no matter what the price is.
Yeah. And you do go through phases. I think bourbon is the big one now. I have a feeling we have some bourbon drinkers who are listening based on the keen eye on your bar. G. Blackburn, I wanted to say Gary, I don't even know if that's right, but G. Blackburn asking 70% cash. Did I hear that right? That's not bullish. But I think it's because you just started and you haven't had a chance
to deploy it all. This is just for the fun. I'm 100% allocated personally outside of the Alpine Fox. And I'm planning to sort of average in, scale into some positions over, call it a month to 6 months, right? Because I have a 3-year hard lock. It's very unusual terms, by the way, for a first-time manager. I negotiated very hard for that, but I have a 3-year hard lock. And so essentially, I don't have to worry about performance until the first quarter of 2026. And so again, my focus is what can I buy over the next, call it 3 to 6 to 9 months even, that I can hold over that holding period and generate good returns. And so, I don't want to put I don't want to put tens of millions of dollars into the market right now and then have the S&P sell down 30% in the first year. That would be a really dumb thing to do as a professional manager. But obviously, personally, I'm not too concerned with that.
Yeah, so you're definitely interested in keeping some powder dry mm-hmm. as you look around to deploy. Paul asking about utilities. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, utilities are great when you're kind of going into a recessionary period. I think we sort of entered the recessionary period, candidly, in the Q3, Q4 of 2021. That's when the market started to price in higher rates, particularly in Q4. And those high-flying tech stocks, the meme stocks, the SPACs, cryptocurrencies, they all started to sell off of then. And so that was a time where I would have been interested maybe in owning Duke Energy or something like that at that time. Across a full cycle, though, I'm not particularly excited about that business model versus like what I can get with other infrastructure businesses like Bitcoin miners, right? And so again, Bitcoin is a subsector of what I cover, but the Bitcoin mining businesses were trading just a month ago. They were trading like they were all going to go to zero. And the most interesting analogy for that is the internet data center businesses back in 2001, 2002. So if you think back to that time, coming out of the dot-com crash, companies like Equinix were trading at like $3 a share, you know, and later, of course, over the course of 15, 18 years, that stock went up 200, 300x. Really, it was just a binary bet on the future of the internet. Like if you thought the internet had a future, you wanted to be long the infrastructure businesses that were supporting the internet. If you think Bitcoin has a future coming off the bottom here at 15, 16K last month or in December, then you probably want to own the infrastructure businesses supporting the growth of the Bitcoin network. And so I would prefer to put a dollar into a Hut 8 or a Cypher or something like that over a utility business or a traditional internet data center business, because I just think the returns are going to be lower over the next 3 years. And again, there'll be volatile stocks. But if you want exceptional returns, you have to fish in those areas.
And Ralph was asking about Bitcoin miners. Are you concerned about some have declared bankruptcy? I know you just said they're volatile, but are you concerned about companies that you think are good companies getting swept up in some of what we're seeing, the fallout or the contagion in the industry?
No, and the reason is simple. For the most part, the high quality real infrastructure developers are really not involved or engaged in any way with any of these offshore platforms that have blown up. Right. And so I can speak directly to this. I'm on the board of a NASDAQ listed Bitcoin miner. The ticker is IREN. It's called Iris Energy. It's actually an Australian domiciled company, but all of our facilities are in British Columbia, in Canada. We have three operating facilities there, one new one coming online in Texas. The business is really just an infrastructure business. The company buys land, the company builds buildings, the company buys computing equipment, the company plugs that computing equipment into a power source, runs the machines and generates Bitcoin, and then they sell the Bitcoin every day at the market price. So they're no different than somebody mining any other asset. They don't carry any Bitcoin on the balance sheet. They have no daily exposure to any counterparties. They just make Bitcoin every day in Canada and sell it in the open market. And so the value is just, what's the value of that infrastructure in terms of its ability to generate revenue over the next 3, 5, 7 years? And I think the market is dramatically underpricing the value of those infrastructure assets in the same way it was dramatically undervaluing the value of Equinix's infrastructure assets in 2002. And again, this is still a very contrarian, it's why I'm so confident that it's a good idea. It's highly contrarian. Bitcoin is still contrarian, but then if you don't understand Bitcoin, you wouldn't understand why you would ever build data centers to mine it. But I think it's a quite interesting opportunity.
And you own Bitcoin as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can go up to 40% of the fund in Bitcoin. Of course, personally, I own millions of dollars of Bitcoin. So,
and what is your outlook? We've seen a big rally to start the year, but do you expect it to be correlated with risk assets in the way it was last year? Is that an issue for you at all? Or because of your time horizon, you're just confident on its sort of ability and function and will ride the waves of volatility?
Yeah, the second one, you kind of hit it. I mean, if you do enough fundamental work on Bitcoin, the only bet you're making is, does it survive? Because what tends to happen is if it survives across 2, 3, 5, 7 year periods, again, we don't have a lot of time periods to judge this on, but based on the structure of it, I'm highly confident that it will probably be around in 5 or 10 years. And if it's around in 5 or 10 years, its inflation schedule is known because it's algorithmic and dictated by code, whereas the Fed's money printing scheme is sort of unknown. It's a known unknown. We know it's going to happen. We just don't know how bad it's going to be. We don't know how many dollars are going to be printed. We don't know how much debasement is going to take place. We don't know how much inflation is going to happen. But we do know there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin. So to me, it's just a simple math problem. It's a scarce asset. As long as there's demand, fundamental demand for the asset, the price will go up. And that demand is actually coming from the emerging world in large part. That's where you see real fundamental demand. In the Western world, it's primarily speculation. Mm. It's investment managers. It's traders. It's people who like to watch a chart and see a chart that shows volatility and say, wow, this reminds me of corn or cotton or 20 years ago, 50 years ago. It reminds me of silver or gold, and I can trade it. But in the emerging world, people are literally trying to outrun monetary debasement, right? Their central banks are just stealing their money, essentially. And so they buy it for those fundamental reasons. As long as that continues, Bitcoin's probably going to go up in price. And if it is, there are a bunch of ancillary businesses like Coinbase or like Iris Energy that'll probably go up over time as well.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
We have a question from ZS. Will Bitcoin allocation change over halving cycles or adoption more broadly?
Say again. Will Bitcoin's
allocation change over halving cycles or adoption more broadly?
Is he saying for me, will my Bitcoin allocation?
I'm not sure. It wasn't clear. Maybe you can make that clear, ZS. But what are you thinking about in terms of adoption? Is that an issue? We saw institutions get involved. Mm-hmm. And then they pulled back, and you know, there is the thought that they are kind of waiting in the wings, as well. Now, does that matter to your thesis?
I mean, look, BlackRock is all over this, right? But BlackRock is coming into space in a major way. There's going to be pauses in adoption in the U.S. whenever there are regulatory issues, right, or whenever there are sort of market events like we just had last year. Whenever an asset falls 60, 70, 80%, there's carnage. Right? There's carnage in a lot of different places. All the frauds are revealed. All the Ponzi schemes are revealed. We just saw that. That has nothing to do with the operations of the Bitcoin protocol itself. It has to do with the centralized entities that are trading in the space. And so I don't think that really matters in the long run. I think over a 3, 5, 7 year period, you can kind of just draw a line. It's kind of up and to the right to be simple and plain, but it's just up and to the right. And it shows you kind of where the adoption is going. And if it continues like that, then the price will sort of follow along.
So we have a couple of questions. They're great questions today, everyone, by the way. And obviously, a lot of people consider themselves, I think, this time horizon matches up with some of what they're doing, whether it's personally or professionally. And so they have a lot of questions about how you think about this. One of them is, do you get frustrated if you find a great value company, but its share performance is poor and refuses to participate in the markets?
I tend to like that because it gives you more time to accumulate the stock, right? And so if it truly is a great company, and as you continue to underwrite and re-underwrite it, you can't find any reason why there's something wrong with it, then you should probably add more, right? If you're a value investor. Like, I can give you a good example. CVS in 2018 and 2019 kind of went into the tank. It was bouncing around in the low 50s, right? It was like 7-8 times earnings. BMY did this as well around the same time, Bristol Myers Squibb. It was bouncing around in the low to mid 40s. It's when I acquired a large stake in both of them at that time. And they mostly didn't recover right away. They would recover a little bit and then trade back down. And every time they would dip back down, I would just continue to add, because as long as I saw in the earnings trajectory, I saw an improving business in both cases, I didn't have any real concern. So over a full cycle, like a 5, 7, or 9, 11 year type of time horizon, right? Like, the earnings tend to guide the prices back to where they're supposed to be. And so if you get a long period of time to continue to add to a great company at a low price, I'd say continue investing. It doesn't tend to bother me that much.
Yeah, and you're not chasing it. Also a question about, does tangible book value fit into your process?
Yeah, to the extent at which the business has hard assets, right? Remember, a big increasing chunk of the S&P, when you think about the underlying value, is coming from IP across time. Like, we can just see that in the data. Like, Google, the value isn't because they own some building in Hudson Yard or something in New York. The value is in the algorithms, the value is in the data, the value is in the software, the value is in the code, the intellectual property, and the people. And so to the extent at which you're investing in technology or technology-driven businesses, it can be challenging if you have to be so tethered to kind of a traditional property, plant, and equipment kind of item in the balance sheet, right? Because up until kind of the technology industry really took off in the US, that would have been a primary way that you would know you were getting value. You could still kind of do that from time to time. Like, I'll give you an example. Hut 8 is a company that I own that, you know, it went down a lot last year, but sometime in December, I was doing Twitter Spaces. I kept pointing out to people the stock was trading at 80 or 85 cents, and they had like 75 cents of cash in Bitcoin on the balance sheet. Plus, they have a bunch of operating facilities, right? And so I was looking at that and I'm saying, the market's basically saying that this business has no value, right? Because if you liquidated the whole thing right now, you would have the entire share price in cash and Bitcoin. And so you can still find that even in the tech space, but you have to look kind of for situations that are kind of deeply depressed, like we saw at in December in crypto. Crypto was just in the depression phase. Mm-hmm. I think it just kind of popped out of it over the last month.
You're talking a lot about Bitcoin. Do you look at other areas of crypto, ETH, or any companies that are associated with building out infrastructure for the metaverse or anything like that?
I try not to go too far away from Bitcoin just because I think Bitcoin's the only asset that's proven that it'll still be around in 20 years. Ethereum is still an experimental project. They keep changing the code. They keep changing the rules over time. I own some personally, just as a speculation. I bought the most recent round. I bought it like $300 a few years ago. So I have like a pretty small position personally. I don't think I'm going to put it in the fund just because it doesn't really fit the mandate. And then beyond that, I think the metaverse is still a show me story. Like, we actually need to see viable use cases for some of this stuff. Like, I think Mark Zuckerberg candidly kind of put his stock into the toilet by doing this huge pivot in there. And I think he might've just been a little bit too early. It may still be a material thing, but I don't think I need to bet on things like that to make a lot of money.
Yeah. And too early is hard because you can go bankrupt while you're waiting for the timing to adjust itself, as we know. It's been a fascinating conversation, Mike. And, you know, as I'm listening, my takeaway is that you make a compelling case that we're back to a period where active management is going to count. And from listening to you, it's clear that you drill down and understand these companies well. And when you see value and you see an attractive yield, you're kind of willing to hold it regardless of some of the short-term gyrations.
That's right. And I think if you use high yield equity as a bond allocation, you're going to do much better over the next 5 years than just holding bonds. Now, of course, if the interest rates start falling dramatically, bonds could go up quite a lot, but that's just not something I want to bet on. I'd rather bet on growth in energy or growth in healthcare and use that to get an above average yield versus betting on somebody paying back a note, you know, the US government or some corporation. So I think you want to bet on the industries that have nice tailwinds going, but I think that's energy, healthcare, and a few others.
And some of the infrastructure around Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a no-brainer. But again, for me, that's going to be probably no more than 10 to 20% of the portfolio. I think it needs to be sized right because the stocks can go down a lot in a nasty recession.
Yeah. And even if you have a long time horizon, that's still hard. That's still hard to see happen. Mike, fantastic stuff. This was so interesting. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the fund.
Thank you, Maggie.
We will see you again soon, I hope. Thanks to all of you for watching and the great questions. We'll be back with you tomorrow. In the meantime, take care and good luck out there.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.